ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
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 Dikarinam
Arudha
Shushubhe
Swarat
Yatha
Shravat
Prashvavanam
Udaya Adnam Ahapati Airavatam Dikarinam
Airavatam Dikarinam
Arudha Shushubhe Swarat
Arudha Shushubhe Swarat
Yathashravat Prashravanam
Yathashravat Prashravanam
Udayadrim Ahapati
Udayadrim Ahapati
O King, O descendant of Maharaj Pandu, the soldiers of both the demigods and demons were decorated by canopies, colorful flags, and umbrellas with handles made of valuable jewels and pearls. They were further decorated by fans made of peacock feathers and by other fans also. The soldiers, their upper and lower garments waving in the breeze, naturally looked very beautiful. And in the light of the glittering sunshine, their shields, ornaments, and sharp, clean weapons appeared dazzling. Thus, the ranks of soldiers seemed like two oceans with bands of aquatics. For that battle, the most celebrated commander-in-chief, Maharaj Bali, son of Vairochana, was seated on a wonderful airplane named Vaihayasa. O King, this beautifully decorated airplane had been manufactured by the demon Maya and was equipped with weapons for all types of combat. It was inconceivable and indescribable. Indeed, it was sometimes visible and sometimes not. Seated in this airplane under a beautiful protective umbrella and being fanned by the best of chamaras, Maharaj Bali, surrounded by his captains and commanders, appeared just like the moon rising in the evening, illuminating all directions. Surrounding Maharaj Bali on all sides were the commanders and captains of the demons, sitting on their respective chariots. Among them were the following demons: Namuchi, Shambhara, Bana, Viprachitti, Ayomukha, Dvimurdha, Kalanava, Praheti, Heti, Ilvala, Shakuni, Bhuta Santapa, Vajradamstra, Virochana, Hayagriva, Shankushira, Kapila, Megadundubhi, Taraka, Chakradrik, Shumba, Nishumba, Jamba, Utkala, Arista, Aristanemi, Triparadipa, Maya, the sons of Paloma, the Kaleyas, and the Nivata Kavacha. All these demons had been deprived of their share of the nectar and had shared merely in the labor of churning the ocean. Now they fought against the demigods, and to encourage their armies, they made a tumultuous sound like the roaring of lions and blew loudly on conch shells. Balabit, Lord Indra, upon seeing the situation of his ferocious rivals, became extremely angry. Sitting on Airavata, an elephant who can go anywhere and who holds water and wine in reserve for showering, Lord Indra looked just like the sun rising from Udayagiri, where there are reservoirs of water. On the top of the mountain called Udayagiri are large lakes from which water continuously pours in waterfalls. Similarly, Indra's carrier, Airavata, holds water and wine in reserve and showers it in the direction of Lord Indra. Thus Indra, king of heaven, sitting on the back of Airavata, appeared like the brilliant sun rising above Udayagiri. Om Ganachandandasya Gyananjanashlakaya Chakshunvitamina Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha. Such an opulent description of a battlefield and soldiers engaged in warfare. Jewels, peacock feather fans, flags, umbrellas with handles made of jewels and pearls, clean, sharp weapons, dazzling. And then you hear about Maharaj Bali. He's got his airplane, which is inconceivable and indescribable. Sometimes it's visible, sometimes not. And Bali appears like the moon rising in the evening, illuminating all directions. And Indra appears like the sun rising. That's how glorious the scene is. So many extraordinary personalities. You may wonder, why is it we went through a long list of the names of demons who were associated with Bali Maharaj? Well, the Bhagavatam is giving credit where credit is due. Even though Bali Maharaj's commanders and captains were demons, they were great personalities from the material point of view. It's just that they were not cooperating with the demigods. They were not cooperating with Vishnu. Still, they were great persons, so the Bhagavatam mentions their names. And the Bhagavatam is pointing out that what's the reason for the fight? All these demons had worked hard with the demigods to churn the ocean to produce nectar. But when the nectar was produced, the demons had been deprived of their share by the incarnation of Godhead in the form of a woman, Mohini Murti. As we described yesterday or so, the demons were temporarily mesmerized by Mohini Murti. But afterwards, they realized they'd been cheated, and the demigods had gotten all the nectar. So now the demons want to attack. Because of anger, because of embarrassment, because of envy, now the battle is starting. You can tell by this description of the opulences of the armies that Vedic civilization was far superior to what we know of today. Even in battle, there was so much opulence.
Are you ready to party?
Are you saying that's also a battle? So, even in battle, such luxury and opulence. And Kshatriyas like to fight. This is not a misery for them. It's not that they have to be drafted by the army, conscription. No, because they're of military spirit. This is their prime activity in life. All right. The fighting is going on. You might wonder, why is it that apparently the Lord favored the demigods? Mohini Murti gave the demigods all the nectar. The demons weren't worthy. Okay. But why is it that the Lord personally intervened on behalf of the demigods? Krishna gives anyone a chance to be a Sura. Krishna gives anyone a chance to be a Devata. The chance is available equally to everyone. But if you take up that chance, then you become special to Krishna. So everyone gets an equal chance to be special to the Lord. He says this in Bhagavad Gita. Samaham sarvabhuteshu. I'm equal to everyone. I don't favor anyone. But if you become a devotee, then you get special treatment. But how is that favoritism when everyone has a chance to be a devotee? Therefore, you can't accuse the Lord of being partial to the demigods, as if no one else has a chance to receive that special treatment. But it's natural that the Lord is enlivened by those who accept his will. just like you're teaching in school. Some students, they do whatever the teacher says. I'm sure you've experienced that when you went to school. They were the goody-goody students. And whatever the teacher said, they, yes, yes. If the teacher said jump, they say how high. I don't know if any of you were students like that in school. So the teacher feels very happy with such students. And they actually make the teacher's day. Oh, I have such, I have a group of really talented students who are really eager to accept my contribution. I had many teachers and principals of schools in my family, and so they always would talk like that, you know. Oh, that student is such a pearl, so wonderful. I really can do something with that student. But naturally, the teacher is enlivened when there are students who listen and take very seriously what the teacher says. But then, you know, in your high school class, there's other kind of students, too. Maybe you were one of those types. Yeah, in the back of the classroom, making jokes and passing notes and rolling up paper and throwing them at other students and checking out the opposite sex. Yeah, the teacher can be pouring his or her heart out trying to give good instruction, but these students, you know, it's just water off a duck's back. They're just not into it. They're just waiting for the class to be over. Now, you can't blame the teacher for being enlivened by the good students. It's natural. Similarly, you cannot blame Krishna for being enlivened by the suras, those who are taking his order seriously. That is natural. But everyone has a chance to be a devata by changing your behavior. It's not just a question of birth. It is all about your current behavior. What about Nalakuvara and Manigriva, the sons of Kuvera? They took birth in the demigod society. Their father was Kuvera, the treasurer of the heavenly planets. But what happened? They became blinded by that opulence. And they became intoxicated, playing with young girls in the Mandakini Ganges River, showing you that you can even enter the Ganges River and perform sinful activities. It's not that everyone who enters the Ganges is automatically purified. If you have the mentality for committing sinful activity, then you can even go in the Ganges and you won't be purified. So this is what Nalakuvara and Manigriva were doing. They were stoned out of their minds and sporting with young girls without any clothes in the Mandakini Ganges River. Well, Narada Muni came along, and the young girls immediately raced for their clothes. We don't want to be seen naked in front of Narada Muni. But Nalakuvara and Manigriva were so drunk, they didn't even take notice of Narada Muni. So Narada Muni cursed them. Now you may say, aha, once again, we have another example of partiality. The Supreme Lord stands up for the demigods, and here you see Narada Muni getting angry and cursing. But what was the nature of Narada Muni's curse? It was actually a benediction. Because by his curse, the two sons of Kuvera got the darshan of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in Vrindavan. In this way, you can see that everything that a saintly person does has benefit. Even an apparent curse. The example is given by the acharyas that sometimes a child needs to take medicine and the child is deeply asleep. So the parent comes and pinches the child to wake the child up to take the medicine. Now, is that pinching of the child malicious? No, it's to benefit the child. We have to learn to see how Krishna is dealing with us so that we'll take our medicine. Sometimes Krishna has to do things to wake us up because we have deep material attachments, or fooling ourselves, we're playing games. So Krishna arranges a situation in which you get a pinch for your betterment. A devotee appreciates everything that Krishna does. And Narada Muni is representing Krishna. So he cursed those boys. Nalakuva and Manigriva. You like to be naked? Take birth as trees. But not ordinary trees. Take birth as trees in Vrindavan. And there'll come a time when you will see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. Knowing that, baby Krishna dragged down the Yamala Arjuna trees to fulfill the blessings of Narada Muni. The Lord, in his Damodar Leela, is showing you he's under the control of his devotees. He's under the control of Mother Yashoda, who bound him to the grinding mortar. He's also under the control of Narada Muni. And therefore he's fulfilling the words of Narada Muni. Now, is it that the Lord is dependent on his devotees? He says in Bhagavad Gita, Patram Pushpam Palam Toyam Yome Bhakta Priyasati. Offer me a leaf, fruit, flower, or water, I'll accept. If there's devotion, I'll eat. Yeah. If there's devotion, Krishna says, I'll eat. In fact, the acharyas point out that how can the Lord eat a flower? He says, you offer me a leaf, fruit, flower, or water, I'll accept. But how can he eat a flower? But the confidential meaning is that even if his devotee offers him a flower, if it's with devotion, out of ecstasy the Lord will eat the flower. You know, in Nectar Devotion, the example of Vidura, he's absorbed in ecstatic love, he's offering bananas to the Lord, and he's peeling the bananas to offer them to Krishna, and he's giving the Lord the banana skins, he's throwing away the bananas, the inside. But because of his pure devotion, the Lord is accepting. Similarly, Lord, he'll eat a flower if it's offered with devotion by his devotee. Now, does this mean the Lord is dependent on his devotees? This is what the demons think. Vishnu is always paid off by the demigods. They're always bribing him. Vishnu is like a little boy who can be bribed with sweets. That's what Hiranyakashipu thought. He was especially angry because Vishnu had killed his brother Hiranyaksha. So this was Hiranyakashipu's analysis. The demigods bribe Vishnu, and they get him to do whatever they like. And therefore Vishnu killed my brother. So in order to atone for this, in order to satisfy my brother, I'm going to have to kill Vishnu. Then my brother will be happy. Demons always give themselves a false sense of honor. So here Hiranyakashipu is presenting himself that, you know, I'm going to avenge my brother. I'm not uncivilized. If someone kills my brother, I'll kill that person. He's presenting himself as having this kind of integrity. Don't think I'm just going to stand there and let Vishnu kill my brother and not do something back. No, I'm a man of honor. I'll chop Vishnu's head off. I have to do that for the memory of my brother. Who else said like that? What other demon referred to as, you know, he's having to discharge a burden by killing Krishna. Huh? No, it was Dantavakra. Dantavakra. He, after the death of Shishupal, Dantavakra marched towards Krishna with steps shaking the ground. And he didn't even have any weapons. He was so angry. who is this Krishna to kill my friend Shishupal? As if Krishna had been unprovoked by Shishupal. Shishupal had done everything to finally Krishna killed him. So, in any case, the demons never see things clearly. All Dantavakra knew was, you killed my friend Shishupal. Never mind what Shishupal did. So he marched towards Krishna, armed only with his anger. He didn't even have the consciousness to bring his full battle regalia. The Lord saw him coming like that, and so the Lord also, playing the part of a kshatriya, got off of his chariot and divested himself of most of his weapons, so it'd be a fair fight. So what were Dantavakra's words? It's a very great privilege to see you, Krishna, standing here before me. Krishna, you're my cousin, and I shouldn't have to kill you.
Yeah, he's presenting himself as an honorable gentleman. Normally I don't kill my cousins.
But you killed my friend Shishupal. So now, like a surgeon removing a boil, I must kill you. Because I'm very obliged to my friends. He's giving himself honor. I'm very obliged to my friends. So to discharge my debt to Shishupal, don't wonder, Krishna, why I'm going to kill you. And it's a great honor to be before you and to kill you. So this is the demoniac mentality. Some or other, squeeze out some false honor for yourself. Do the most abominable things and be able to rationalize it and present yourself as having integrity. This is all that goes on today. People, somehow or other, figure out how they have good qualities in spite of doing the most abominable things. I mean, how many people do you meet in the course of your social interactions, in the course of your preaching, who will just tell you, I'm just out and out rotten. I'm just disgusting. I'm a savage. I'm abominable. How many people do you meet like that? Now, their lifestyle is like that, but they don't think that about themselves. Before coming in contact with Lord Chaitanya's mercy, we did not think like that about ourselves. Did any of you, really? Any of you before coming in contact with Krishna consciousness think, I'm just a low-life scum. I'm just, I'm just horrible. You could have been completely absorbed in Kali Yuga activities, but still you kind of thought, well, yeah, I'm a nice person, you know? I'm a caring person. I don't do that many bad things. This is the way it is in the influence of Maya. You give yourself credit for something. No one pays attention to what the Shastra says. And as we spoke a few days ago, it is the Shastra that discriminates between divine and demoniac behavior. As long as we feel that it's up to me, it's according to how I feel, what I think is right, then we're in the demoniac category. So this is the basic incompatibility between the suras and the asuras. There'll be no agreement on this point. The suras do not base your life on shastra. They say it's all up to you, how you feel, what's right or wrong. And the suras base everything on shastra. That's why the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, Yashastra vidim uchstridja bhartate kamakarata. Nasa siddham avapnoti nasukam na paramgati. If you give up the shastra, and you, of course, why would you do that? Out of lust, kamakarata. I feel a certain way, so what do we need but these holy books? They're nice to keep on your shelf, but when real life happens, you've got to make your own decisions based on your heart. You know your heart better than anyone. You know what you need. That's the deciding point. You've got to decide what's good for you right now. This is Demania. Kama Karata. You're pushing aside the Shastra, throwing it away. Or maybe not exactly throwing it away, but just keeping it on the bookshelf. Yes, there, okay, right. I'll get to you one day. But right now, I've got to do what I feel. And that's natural. Everyone's doing like that. If I don't do how I feel, I'm going to be not going to be a psychologically healthy person. I won't be true to myself. I've got to do what I feel. I've got to be real. I've got to be me. This is demoniac. As if the Shastra has no idea what you are, and the Shastra has no idea what your benefit is, what your real benefit in life is. We have to get this point firmly embedded in our consciousness. That the Shastra rules our life. Pravittam cha, nivittam cha, janana vidurasara. As we spoke a few days ago. The demons have no idea what to do or what not to do. It's all based on how they feel. But the devotee, the devata, he conforms to Krishna's injunctions. And instead of trying to always push aside Krishna's injunctions, the devata, the demigod, is trying to understand how to apply these instructions. It is not that this world is without an instruction book. Those who are demoniac act in that way. It's like you get a new computer or some new appliance and you act like there's no instruction book coming along with it. You ever seen people like that? They get something new and they just never read the manual. It's like a policy. Well, you know, we'll push this button, we'll do this, we'll do that. Never think about reading the manual. You've seen many people like that? Well, that's how some of us live our lives. We don't take the manual seriously. That is not human life. All right. So you're having this battle. It appears that the Lord is partial. But that is not so. Everyone has a chance to get Krishna's favor. Still, it can appear that way. And it's a major question in the Shastra. In the seventh canto, Prichit Maharaj, first chapter of seventh canto, he put this question before Shukadev Goswami because it's very troubling. He said, now, we know the Lord is a friend of everyone. We know Krishna has no friends or enemies in the material sense. But then why does it appear that he sides with the demigods against the demons? This is very perplexing. Prichit Maharaj is presenting like that. We accept, we know that Krishna is equal to everyone. Suradam Sarvadeva, Sarvabhuta. We know that. But it doesn't look like that. It seems like he's always favoring the demigods and killing demons. This is the same thing that Hiranyakashipu was roaring in his offensive way. Vishnu is just like a little kid who can be bought off by some sweets. And therefore he killed my brother on the behest of the demigods. So Prichit Maharaj is saying, it can look like that. It's a major point. Hiranyakashipu had a good point. Although he presented it in such an offensive way, he had a good point. Now Prichit Maharaj is presenting that point in a very humble way. First of all, he makes the assertion of the absolute truth. We know Without a doubt, the Lord is equal to everyone. We know the Lord has no friends or enemies, but it can look like something else. Why is that? What's going on? And Pritchard Maharaj further embellishes that first question. He said, people have friends. Why? Because they want benefit from the friends. And people have enemies. Why? Because they fear persons. They fear persons. They're envious of persons. Therefore, they are enemies. But how can Krishna have friends or enemies when the Lord doesn't need to benefit from anyone? Nor does the Lord need to fear anyone or envy anyone. So then, what's going on? Why is the Lord apparently siding with the demigods? Just like in the churning of the ocean. Both the demons and the demigods were working hard. But the demons did not get the result. They were cheated by Mohini Murti. So what is the answer? First of all, Sukadeva Goswami explains that when you take shelter of material nature, you get certain results. You cannot blame the Lord for that. Although the Lord did set up material nature, you, when you take shelter of material nature, generate your own fate. It's just like, let's say, you build a big machine. And then what others do with that machine, that's their problem. You've even left a manual that if you use the machine like this, you'll benefit. If you use the machine like that, you'll suffer. So how can they blame you? What they do with the machine is their own business. Even though you made it, you've given clear instructions. This is how you benefit. This is how you lose. So Krishna has done that. Material nature is like a machine which has been set into motion by the Supreme Lord. Now you can't blame Krishna for how people interact with that machine. You act towards a machine in one way, you get one result. You act towards it another way, you get another result. Just like electricity here. You have power points here. Now, is it the electric company's fault if a little kid comes and sticks a metal thing in there and gets a shock? Is that the fault of the electric company? Not at all. It's up to you whether you stick a metal thing in there and get a shock, or you stick a plug in there and you get some benefit by running your appliances. That's up to you. You can't blame the electric company. So that's why Krishna says in the Gita, Yayatam Aham Prapadyate Tam Satyava Bhajamyaham. As you surrender to me, I reciprocate with you. In other words, you want to stick a metal thing into the PowerPoint, you'll get a shock. Or you want to put a plug in there, you'll get benefit. It's up to you. So, when you take shelter of material nature will drag you in its own way. The demigods have chosen to take shelter of sattva-gun, mode of goodness. Therefore, generally, they predominate. And the demons choose to take shelter of rajagun and tamagun, passion and ignorance. So therefore, generally, they're defeated. It's just a matter of how you take shelter of material nature. And of course, the demigods do more than take shelter of modes of goodness. They're following Krishna's instructions. And the goal is that they should give up their attachment to controlling and become pure devotees of the Lord. But if you look at the demigods just from the point of view of being in the mode of goodness, that accounts for their predominance. But it's not Krishna's partiality. Anyone can change their interaction with the modes of nature. We can do that also. It's not a question of birth. We were talking about the sons of Kuvera, how although they were in such a high position in the celestial world, they fell down to the mode of ignorance because of drinking, passionate affairs, rajagun, sporting with young ladies in the river, even the Ganges River. Those in high positions can fall down. those in low positions can rise. Just like Srila Prabhupada said about so many of the devotees who took shelter of him. He said, devotees asked him, well, don't you have to have some kind of pious activities as a background to taking up devotional service? And Prabhupada just said point blank, I created your pious activities. So many of us can't even say that we had a, you know, background of pious activities, and from that we took the step toward bhakti. This is an example of how from low birth you can go to a high position, or from high birth you can go to a low position. Everything depends on your activities. Because you can change your material nature. At the time of birth, your body is composed of a particular mode of nature, predominantly. You can change that. If you conduct yourself in a mode of goodness, then your life will change. You cannot accuse Krishna of being partial. The demigods conduct themselves generally in a mode of goodness. And therefore, they predominate. You cannot say this is Krishna being swayed by them. That's the demoniac view. These devotees make a few offerings to the Lord and he becomes swayed like a little child. We are demons. We're not going to do that silly stuff. We know it's all up to our prowess. That is the demoniac view. Still, this subject matter of is the Lord partial or impartial is perplexing. Therefore, Prichit Maharaj is raising it to Shukadev Goswami. Now, how does Shukadev Goswami solve the riddle? He explains that partiality and impartiality are characteristics of a material body. But because the Lord has no material body, how can he be partial or impartial? In other words, think before you apply these kind of complexities upon Krishna. You're asking, how can he be partial to the demons? But partiality is the symptom of a material body. Excuse me, how can he be partial to the demigods? Partiality is the symptom of a material body. But because the Lord has no material body, therefore he's the friend of everyone. The material body has likes and dislikes, hates and loves, but the spiritual body does not. The spiritual body simply acts for Krishna's pleasure. Krishna acts for his own pleasure. He's self-sufficient. You'll see that. Bali Maharaj, the king of the demons, becomes a devotee. By the mercy of Prahlad Maharaj, his grandfather. He becomes a Mahajan, one of the 12 authorities in devotional service. Prahlad Maharaj himself is the son of Hiranyakashipu. So in this way, the Lord is showing he's equal to everyone. Even if you're the son of the greatest demon, you can become a bhakta. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Tevi Yanti Param Gatim. Anyone can go back to Godhead. From any social designation. Women, merchants, laborers, anyone can go. Krishna says, I'll take anyone if they take shelter of me. This verse is talking about Airavata, Indra's carrier. An elephant who can go anywhere and who holds water and wine in reserve for showering. There are so many wondrous things in this cosmos. But more wonderful than this cosmos is Krishna's own personal abode. Where Krishna seems to be totally dependent on his devotees. Why is the Lord like that? He He likes to be dependent on his devotees. It doesn't mean he has to be dependent on them. He allows them to control him with their love. He likes that. He voluntarily agrees, control me with your love. It's like when you go to Govardhan in Vrindavan, right near where our temple is, there's a Dhananivartana Kunda. The Kunda, the bathing place where taxes were paid by the gopis when they returned, because they were on their way to a yajna, a sacrifice in Vrindavan, and Krishna and the cowherd boys found out about it. So the Krishna and the cowherd boys stopped the gopis, particularly Krishna's most confidential devotee, gopi, and said, you can't go to the yajna unless you pay tax to us. You've got to give us some milk products, otherwise you're not going anywhere. It's right across the street, basically, from our temple at Govardhan. In this way, a fierce argument ensued. And finally, a deal was worked out that rather than the Lord delaying the gopis from going to the yajna, one of the gopis worked out a deal. We'll deal with this when we come back on the way home. We'll pay the tax. So Krishna and the cowherd boys agreed, okay, we don't want to disrupt your progress to the yajna, but when you come back on the return, then you'll pay the taxes. So what did the gopis do? They, on the return, they got to the spot early. This is Dhananivartana Kunda. And hundreds of them hid behind the bushes, behind trees. So then Krishna and just a few cowherd boys came along, thinking it's just going to be Srimati Radharani, and she's just going to, you know, we'll take the tax, we'll take the milk products. Never did they think there are going to be hundreds of gopis behind the bushes and trees. So they got completely ambushed. They were outnumbered. Hundreds to a few. So the gopis made Krishna bow down at the feet of Srimati Radharani and declare that she's the queen of Vrindavan. Now, Krishna's supreme personality of Godhead. How can he do this? He's doing it out of love. He likes to be dependent on his devotees. Demons cannot understand this. All this shows that Krishna is not the supreme controller. Everything shows that Krishna is the supreme controller because he voluntarily agrees to become conquered by love. This pure love is the most precious thing in existence. By it, even the Supreme Personality of Godhead agrees to be controlled. Any questions?
Just you were mentioning about how part of the demonic nature is that even if we're performing abominable activities, we try to sour sense into compose ourselves somehow when we respect.
Well, you go to school 5 days a week. I mean, the students are all doing abominable activities, most of them, right? So they go around like, wow, I'm really wretched. I'm really disgusting. I'm hellish. They don't say like that, do they?
Not at all.
What do they say?
Oh, I mean, especially there, everyone thinks they're the elite, you know.
Why there?
They're here. Huh? They're the bright ones that went to uni, not the people who went and got a job straight away, you know, the upper crust. And getting rid of the ones that are most respected.
The upper crust on our study, huh?
Any position.
Oh, last time we were talking like this, and what happened? Someone was objecting. Oh, they're not all like that. There's some nice ones.
But I was thinking, you know, a lot of times, I don't know, someone who's into some kind of Eastern, spiritual, even though it's not Vaishnava philosophy, New Age something, we think that that's a good step. You've been explaining how it actually just kind of religion, most of it, if you read these kind of New Age books and you look at them, it's people, they're just justifying their abominable behavior. I'm not trying to make it spiritual.
My opinion, and I had a lot of experience preaching to those type of people, I don't see how it has helped them approach Krishna consciousness at all. They're the most difficult people to preach to because they think, oh yes, spirituality, yeah, I know where you're at. Yeah, I'm spiritual too. You know, we're both doing the same thing, you know? You're chanting Hare Krishna, I'm looking at crystals, it's all, It's just that you have those crazy rules, and we don't have those psychological hang-ups. Turn your backs on love because of those rules. But we just let the love flow without attachment. Unconditional love. That's a popular buzzword amongst them. Unconditional love. So, they're not nice, but some of them are capable of being preached to. Still, their behavior is abominable. We shouldn't lower our standards in terms of our vision in order to feel more comfortable in this world. Well, if we keep saying that almost everyone is so low, then how are we going to relate to the world? You can relate to the world by understanding everyone's actual position. You relate based on compassion, not admiring or giving false credit. Well, actually, they're really nice, There's some really nice meat eaters out there. Some really nice illicit sex persons out there. No, they are living disgusting lives, but some of them can be reached. And when they become touched by Krishna conscious preaching, then they're nice. Otherwise. And it's true, some are worse than others in terms of their activities. Still, our position is that anyone engaged in certain types of activities is low, fallen. But we say that out of compassion, not out of superiority. The mistake sometimes we make is, they're all low, and we devotees are automatically so. That's not the proper attitude. The proper attitude is, they are low, and I was also low. Therefore, let me take advantage of my opportunity to be elevated. And part of taking advantage of my opportunity to be elevated is to help them become elevated. And they'll probably be better devotees than me. That's what a preacher thinks. Let me help this person because this person will probably turn out to be a better devotee than me. The spiritual master thinks my disciples are actually little spiritual masters sent by Krishna to me for me to train them up. It's like Prabhupada writes in the fourth canto, the section where Dhruva Maharaj is going back to Vaikuntha and he thinks, what about my mother? She's the one who first showed me the path of Krishna Bhakti. She should go back to Godhead too. And as soon as he thought that, he looked and saw his mother in a Vaikuntha chariot heading for Vaikuntha also. So Prabhupada writes in the purport that writes something to the effect that my lowly self is also thinking that maybe I'll have a disciple who's so powerful in spiritual attainment that by the devotional service of the disciple, I'll be taken back to Godhead. That is humility. So we should not shy away from evaluating things according to the Shastra, but we must have compassion. And how can we not have compassion? Because except for Lord Chaitanya's mercy, we were the same way. Or would have been the same way. Sometimes devotees have a hard time discriminating between proper evaluation and compassion. They think, if you're properly evaluating something, you're not compassionate. That's not true. Call a spade a spade. People are fallen, low, debased, even the best of them. But out of compassion, we're trying to help. And we know that if they take Krishna consciousness, they'll be better than us. That is the way a devotee thinks. It's hard to understand, though. Non-devotees, that is, have a hard time understanding this. Why are you always down on people? So what if they eat meat? So what if they have a list of affairs? So what if they take a little intoxication? There's a lot of nice people out there. They don't understand that we're making these pronouncements based on compassion and honesty. We're staying true to Krishna's vision. Krishna is the complete whole. All living entities are part and parcel of Krishna. So Krishna has a right to say, these are the good ones, these are the bad ones. We're just repeating that. It is not integrity to overlook what Krishna says and apply your own analysis. Yeah, but actually, they're kind of nice. You can learn a lot from them. Material skills you can learn from non-devotees. But what to do with your life, you can't learn. Any questions? Yes?
The strange situation where they have such debauched activities in society, but then there's a great hue and cry when their politicians do such activities, you know, such as the Clinton affair, where they're involved in some risk. Next thing the whole society is complaining, and yet the society itself is involved in all the same activity.
Did they complain in Australia about that? I don't know that. Many leaders of many countries are speaking about that particular affair, the Clinton affair. Many leaders said, what's the big deal, you know? He's just doing what we all do. Some leaders of nations even sent a personal message to the president saying that, hey, we don't understand what the big deal is. You know, it's all part of the job, you know? It goes along with the salary. Some actually wrote that. Really? In Australia, people really got wired up about that?
Well, there's cases like that here, and people.
Really?
Yeah,
they get what? Yeah. It's some kind of strange psychology.
It's not a government standard.
But people want to feel that if you're in political office, you should be serving the people. You shouldn't be serving yourself. Now, that's a bit unrealistic. Because the society has no conception of selfless service. Selfless service can only be in relation to Krishna. Otherwise, anytime someone says, I'm doing selfless service, you have a right to be suspicious. Selflessness can only function in relation to Krishna. Otherwise, there's always some sense gratification somewhere. Everyone should think that I'm a very charitable person. Everyone should appreciate me. I've talked to people whose lives are dedicated to charity. And they told me it's true. They actually think like that. The big moment in their lives is like the annual charity ball or banquet where they get recognized. And here, our greatest supporter of the, you know, heart fund or, you know, multiple sclerosis fund, our greatest supporter, our champion, our mainstay, so-and-so. And it was, And they, people who work in that field of philanthropy, they tell me that's their biggest charge in life. It's just like, a sports star scoring the winning try in the World Cup or something. They actually feel like that. It's such a rush. Such an adrenaline rush. Oh, yes, I've done good. And you know it. You've recognized me. I've helped. Everyone's applauding. They give you a plaque. Some people live for that, you know? The pleasure they get from that is more than anything else. So that's the social do-gooders. All right, it's not as bad as other forms of sense gratification. Still, the Shastra is so precise because the Shastra wants to establish pure loving service to Krishna. We have to take that into account. Otherwise, you may start thinking, why are the Vedic literature so severe, criticizing everything, even charitable workers and philanthropists who are doing a lot of good? You must understand the Shastra in relation to pure bhakti. Otherwise, you will get bewildered. Anything else? So being a devotee and seeing things through the eyes of the Shastra doesn't mean that you're condemned to negativity. All right, after class you walk outside and everywhere I see demons, abominable people. That's what it means to be a devotee. That's only part of it. The full picture you should see is fallen people who desperately need your help. And you're thinking, without Krishna consciousness, I'd be worse than them. And with Krishna consciousness, they'll be better than me. That's what you think. So we have to see the whole picture. Sometimes devotees just really get disturbed, you know, one way or the other. Oh, and all this talk about seeing how bad they are. Or some others will say, all this, now, you know, don't try to see false good in them. The full picture is, they are diseased, but with Krishna consciousness, they'll become the best. They'll become better than us. They'll take more advantage of Krishna consciousness than we are now. And without Krishna consciousness, we will be worse than they are now. That's the way a devotee thinks. Anything else? Yes? You're asking me for my opinion? Like asking me for my opinion? Take every penny that you can afford and give it for Krishna's service. That'll be the best way to relieve any problems. You don't know what they're going to do with the money. What does the Gita say about charity in the mode of passion and ignorance? You don't know what they're going to do with the money. You don't know how those charities spend that money. The fact is that for most charities, a huge portion of what they take in terms of donations goes on overhead. More than some of the big, I know in the States, some of the biggest charities, 90%. And then they criticize, you know, Hare Krishna's for doing a little fundraising, you know. 90%. I don't think you have them in Australia. There's one group in the States called the Shriners. They wear these funny hats. And they have them here? Yeah. It's been a proved fact. 90% of their take goes for overhead. 90%. That means big conventions by the seashore and all that kind of stuff. 90%. And 10% goes to their famous hospitals. They have hospitals here too? That's right. In the States, the Shriners have hospitals. And that, you know, and so. But The fact is 90% of all their donations go for overhead, including big conventions and, you know, drunken parties and like that. But if Hare Krishnas take a little bit of money from society, oh, beggars. Why would you give money? Why? You can give them some prasad. Why do you think you should give them money? So they'll think nicely of you? Why can't you just honestly tell them the truth? You don't have any money. That's true, isn't it? And you can make sure you don't have any money by giving anything beyond what you need to live to the temple. Then you're being truthful. I don't have any money. You see how Krishna's service solves everything? You should be in a state of not having money to give to charities. Tell them the truth. I really like to give to you, but I just gave my last dollar to charity, to the supreme charity, the cause of all causes. Tell them the truth. Yesterday I just gave whatever I had, you know, to a not-for-profit cause. Wouldn't that be the truth? Yeah, so why be ashamed of it?
Even the material welfare causes a within this movement anyway. You want drug rehabilitation, you want environmental rehabilitation, these things are here anyway. You can educate people with Christian consciousness and automatically solve these other problems.
Anything else?
From my experience, you are from another human experience, but ultimately you can see in a world that many people who are not religious, but from the point of view of moral codes, they behave quite well. And on the other side, we have many religious persons who behave not so well. And it's really important when you try and sometimes to preach to the karmas and others, they give an effect. They give an effect. So my child abuse, not only Caribbean, being a Christian, so many atrocities in many religions.
But don't let them play games with you like that. Even the atrocities, as you say, done in the name of religion are less than those done without religion, so-called religion. But it's true, when they're done in the world of religion, people really, you know, really stands out. But still, it's not as much as outside, as what goes on outside the world of religion.
The expectation.
Right, the expectation.
The expectation, if you're a religious person, you shouldn't do this. And they think, if you've done this, that your bad equals like 10 or not on the other side.
Because they want to feel good about themselves, that, you know, just see, you call yourself religious, and still there are problems. So what's the point of being religious? Why don't you just be like us? Be honest. That's really what they're saying. Just be honest like us. Don't be religious. But you set yourself up as being religious, and look what's happening.
So I have a question.
What is the question exactly?
The question was, after that hit that you made, you know, so let's be honest, you see you're religious and you have problems, so how do you take it from there to next?
They should understand what real religion is. Then you can have the basis of a discussion. Or, you want to be witty, you can give an answer Prabhupada gave. Someone was saying, well, you know, one devotee did this and that. Why is that going on in your movement? You know, in isolated cases. And Prabhupada answered very significantly, we're not angels, but we're trying. Just trying to be an angel puts you in a rare category. They are not trying. Okay, we don't say we're perfect, but we're trying. That's the most exalted thing, just to try to be perfect. How does that compare to people who don't even know what perfection is? They're not trying. They don't even know what it is. So the fact that our devotees make mistakes, that has to be seen in total perspective. That at least they've tried. Just like in Science of Self-Realization, you read that famous letter from Lynn Ludwig. The lady wrote Prabhupada, you know, your devotees are pestering me. And Prabhupada wrote back, forgive my neophyte disciples, but, you know, they have just given up the material world, therefore they can appear a little enthusiastic in their, you know, in their renunciation. But still, they are far better. But first he said, forgive them, but they are far better. He would acknowledge their neophyte behavior, but say, still, they're the most fortunate. They are better. And you can also be better. But don't let these people intimidate you.
Yeah, I don't have any problem. Not my personal problem, but I've seen many cases. You would see they've been trying to justify their bad behavior. No, I'm doing service. There was no need for me to justify this. That's an underlying emotion.
Well,
and it's
the temple should have a solid core of serious devotees so that you can show what the standard is, because there's always going to be persons who break the standard. Just like householders. Householders must have a group of serious householders to show that it's possible for householders to be dedicated and self-controlled in Krishna's service. When that's not there, you know what all the householders do? You know, no one really follows. We don't know one person in this temple who's following. But when there's a solid core of householders, that dispels the whole illusion. Because you can point, well, look at them, they're following. But this is something the householders have to do. You can't expect the sannyasis to do it. The householders have to establish their standard. Therefore, I was saying a few days ago, you need to have some kind of grihastha committee here for establishing and maintaining the standard of grihastha life. Don't expect the sannyasis to do it. You don't even want that. You don't want us sticking our noses in your affairs. Come on, you guys. You get all the maha and then you want to, you know, stick your nose in our affairs, you know? So the householders should police themselves. They should encourage each other. Then you'll have a healthy temple. Not that someone marries and then they just head out on their own island, you know? Even though they're living one block away from the temple. It's like they're in another universe. So that would be something very healthy. If you do that, you'll see a big difference. Why should our devotees marry and then just have no help, no support, and just reinvent the wheel every year as if, you know, no one's ever been through married life before? So the experienced householders should offer counsel. Prabhupada would lament when householders would fall away, because he said, you're not only losing one person, you're losing two. And you put so much into training them. And then they marry, they go away, you lose two. Double. So if you can establish a strong culture of householders looking out for one another, that'll be a great step forward. If you can establish a strong culture of everybody looking out for each other, that'll be a wonderful step forward. All glories to the Lord.